The outskirts of New Delhi.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Imagine that every state were free to choose whether to allow black people and white people to marry. Some states would permit such marriages, others probably wouldn't. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, America is Not Ready for the End of Roe vs. Wade. Imagine that every state were free to choose whether to allow black people and white people to marry. Some states would permit such marriages, others probably wouldn't. The laws would be a mishmash, and interracial couples would suffer, legally consigned to second-class status depending on where they lived. It seems an unthinkable scenario in 2022. That's because in 1967, the US Supreme Court unanimously ruled that barring interracial marriage, as 16 states still did, violates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection. Under our Constitution, the freedom to marry or not marry a person of another race resides with the individual and cannot be infringed by the state, the court stated in Loving v. Virginia. More than half a century on, Loving is considered one of the court's greatest rulings, and yet it was not universally admired at the time. Southern U.S. states complied only grudgingly, Alabama didn't repeal its ban on interracial marriage until 2000. That's the point of having a federal constitution that is supreme. The guarantees and rights in that document apply to all Americans equally, wherever they live. The court system, and the Supreme Court in particular, exist to protect those rights when state and local authorities refuse to. Many who oppose Roe v. Wade today, and even some who support it, argue that the 1973 ruling short-circuited a running debate over abortion, a debate that should have been allowed to play out in the states, many of which had long banned abortion. This is one of the main justifications in the leaked draft opinion, in which a majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices appear ready to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the 1992 decision that preserved Roe v. Wade's central holding with certain restrictions. The problem with this reasoning is that, as in the Loving case, leaving the matter to individual states and the political process means that millions of Americans will be denied their fundamental rights. In this case, the right of women to decide what happens inside their own bodies. The draft opinion relies heavily on the lack of a mention of abortion in the Constitution, and therefore argues that the document cannot be the basis for the right to terminate a pregnancy. The Constitution also says nothing about interracial marriage, but that didn't prevent the justices from finding in the 14th Amendment the guarantee that no couple may be treated differently because of the color of their skin. In short, constitutional rights are meaningless unless they apply across the entire country. That is why the U.S. Supreme Court decided Loving v. Virginia and Roe v. Wade as it did. These rights are inherent in the Constitution, even if they are not explicit in it. The principle is clear. Women and men should have equal control over their own bodies, as many Americans believed in 1973, and a majority of Americans believe today. And yet, the right to choose whether to terminate a pregnancy is on the verge of being eliminated, because five members of the current U.S. Supreme Court don't like it. Congress has failed repeatedly to codify the protections of Roe v. Wade and Casey in federal law despite various efforts, not only from Democrats but also from two Senate Republicans, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Top Democrats are now left planning a vote on the abortion rights bill that they know has zero chance of passing. This is an empty gesture coming after years of the Democratic Party failing to provide meaningful leadership on reproductive freedom, despite the clear warning signs that Roe v. Wade was endangered. President Biden, as leader of the Democratic Party, has an obligation to take the threat to Americans' constitutional rights seriously by doing all he can to protect access to abortion where it still exists. The White House can encourage regulators to make it easier for women to get medication, abortions, and over-the-counter birth control, to challenge state laws that limit access to medication, abortions, and to lease federal property to abortion providers. This would at least show a commitment to the issue, even if legislative options are limited. Overall, the outlook for reproductive freedom in America is bleak. In 13 states, trigger laws will automatically or very quickly ban abortions after Roe v. Wade is overturned, as seems highly likely. In about a dozen other states, lawmakers are gearing up to severely restrict access to abortions, if not effectively prohibit them, as Texas has already done without interference by the U.S. Supreme Court. The upshot? Within a few months, abortion could be illegal in more than half of the states. The anti-abortion movement isn't stopping there. Efforts are already underway to impose a nationwide ban on abortion as soon as Republicans regain the White House and the Congress, which could happen as soon as 2025. For the foreseeable future, the real battle for reproductive freedom will be fought in the states by regular Americans and their state and local representatives who are trying to protect this fundamental right while they still can. That means, first and foremost, securing more access. California lawmakers are moving quickly to pass a package of bills that would make their state the most populous in the country, also one of the most accessible for women seeking to exercise their reproductive freedom. Those most in need of abortions are often the least able to afford them. States that want to protect reproductive freedom are helping to pay for the procedure and for the travel required to obtain it. Costs that can easily run into thousands of dollars and are prohibitive for many women. Data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention show the percentage of abortion services in Illinois and New York provided to non-residents has already risen sharply over the past decade, a trend driven by increased restrictions on abortions elsewhere in America. New York lawmakers are considering a bill that would direct funds to abortion providers, allowing them to increase staffing and security to meet already rising demand. In March, Oregon lawmakers approved a $15 million fund for these purposes, which should help provide access to abortion not only for residents of the state, but also for those in neighboring states of Idaho, which has already passed a bill that would prohibit abortions after about 6 weeks. All laws are subject to being overturned when the political winds shift, of course. That's why abortion rights groups in some states are focused on their own constitutions. In New York, supporters of abortion rights, including Governor Kathy Hochul, are pushing for a constitutional amendment that would go before New York voters in 2024 to protect reproductive rights in case the state legislature falls into Republican hands. In Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer last month asked her state Supreme Court to rule that the Michigan Constitution affirmatively protects the right to an abortion. Finally, pro-choice states are realizing that they have to play some strategic defense when it comes to protecting abortion providers, and possibly women who get abortions themselves, from states that reach outside their borders to force their anti-abortion laws on everyone else. Missouri lawmakers, for example, are considering a bill that would allow its residents to sue anyone in any state who helps a Missouri resident get an abortion. In anticipation of laws like these, a bill in New York would bar law enforcement authorities from assisting in the out-of-state investigation of abortion providers or women who seek abortions in New York. The Connecticut General Assembly has gone even further, passing a law to allow providers in the state to countersue anyone who sues them for damages for providing abortion care. Meanwhile, in Louisiana, a state that still imposes the death penalty, lawmakers recently passed out of committee a bill that would define fertilized egg as a full person, meaning that anyone who performs an abortion and any woman who obtains one could be charged with murder. What all this shows is that the right to an abortion cannot be left at the mercy of individual states, something that few people on either side of this issue genuinely seem to want. This is why a national standard is necessary. That national standard, at least for a few more weeks, is Roe v. Wade, as modified by Planned Parenthood v. Casey. These two rulings are not perfect, but for all their flaws, they have managed to strike a delicate balance that reflects the public's complex position on a morally fraught issue. The majority of the American people do not want these cases overturned, and an overwhelming majority say that abortion should not be banned outright. If you thought that Roe v. Wade itself led to discord and division, then just wait until it's gone.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Last year today, that's on May 10th, 2021, the Tel Aviv regime launched a war on Gaza. Hundreds of civilians, including women and children, lost their lives or got wounded in the war that lasted 11 days. The fighting is stopped after fierce resistance by Palestinian groups and firing thousands of rockets at the regime, forcing it to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. Attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayat is joining us out of Johannesburg. Also with us will be journalist and activist Khaled Barakat from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let me ask Zakir. Let's begin, Zakir, our discussion by considering the fact that this time around, unlike the previous wars where we had some mediators, this time it was Israel that asked for a ceasefire. What does this signify?
Well, definitely, I think it's a correct reflection of the facts. Israel is a very different state to what it once was. It has now become a glorified police force as opposed to one of the most powerful militaries on the face of this earth. What this signifies is a complete collapse and erosion of the very fundamentals of the state of Israel. Israel was established on the principle of terror. Deir Yassin, we are very familiar of the massacres of Deir Yassin and the terror that was caused and sown into the Palestinian population to allow for mass exodus. This policy becomes cemented, if I can use that word, in 1967 when Arik Shrinum and Ariel Sharon says that the key principle is deterrence capacity, the Arabs' fear of us. And that is the fundamental that is used for many years and even tries to find its roots in 2006 under the instructions of Major General Giora Island, and more closer to home, the head of Northern Command was Hadi Eisenkot. This shows us that after 2006, after the first head-on defeat of Israeli Zionist apartheid colonial settler regime at the hands of the Hezbollah, it has never been able to recover. And now it's not even able to wage an effective war against the starved and besieged population in Gaza or the subjugated occupied Palestinians. It's the end of the Israeli state, and we're seeing it before our eyes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Khaled, what do you think makes Israel regime's last year war on Gaza different? How was it different from the rest of the Israeli invasions?
It was different because the Palestinian resistance involvement in this engagement have unified all Palestinian people behind it, and also it unified not just Palestinians in Palestine from the river to the sea, but also Palestinians in the diaspora as well. And we saw that this time it was different because the Palestinians inside Israel, inside 1948 occupied territories, they were fully engaged and participant in the uprising, the uprising of unity, as some Palestinians called them. And at the same time, it was different because Palestinians have actually demonstrated a very well-organized resistance, where all forms of actions were carried on by Palestinians, whether in the West Bank or Jerusalem or in Lid, in Yaffa, and also outside in the diaspora. And I think that when Palestinians are united, not just in a sentimental way, but in reality and in the program of struggle, we began to see a division in the Zionist regime, internal situation. So when Palestinians are united, also it showed that the Palestinian Authority was irrelevant to this whole scene, and that those Palestinians who have been advocating for negotiations with Israel or security cooperation with Israel were very much marginalized and, put on the side. Palestinians definitely have won in this last round of confrontation.
Now, Zakir, let's now talk about the recent tension and escalation that you hear in the news almost every day in the occupied territories. What factors, in your opinion, have been responsible for the tit Fertat operations almost on a daily basis?
I think it does find its roots in last year's Operation Sefer Quds. And this was a declaration by Israel's own internal military sources, particularly the Miramid Center for Counterterrorism and Intelligence, where they openly declare that a new equation is on the ground. The equation is, if there are any aggressions or attempts to change the status of Bayt al-Maqdis, of al-Quds, there will be a response. What has changed, and we've seen it now in the last few days, is that Israel has been awoken to a new form of operation. So usually they expect a retaliation from Gaza in the form of projectiles, rockets, etc., mortar shells. However, what we are seeing is operations being conducted within the borders of Israel, and this has truly shaken the fundamentals of the Israeli state. What does that mean? The fundamentals of the Israeli state is that they want a war at a distance. They are not a population that can handle confrontation on a day-to-day basis. They are comfortable, they are soft, and they are entitled and privileged, much like the Afrikaner was here in apartheid South Africa. He was entitled, he was privileged, and the African population was fine the distance. It was when the battle is brought to the home front, that is when the situation changed here in South Africa, and I believe that the people of Palestine are in that exact position now. There's a massive change in the modus operandi, and it does put Israel at a massive disadvantage because they don't have the capacity to deal with a multi-front operational attack.
Khaled, the Tel Aviv regime has given its troops full freedom to kill Palestinians. You know, they spot the Palestinians who attack the soldiers, which is a natural response. They kill them, and then they go and attack their villages and towns and destroy their homes. What will be the result of such a practice?
Well, Israel have been doing this since its establishment, the collective punishment of Palestinian population. And we see this over and over on a daily basis, particularly because they want to make the Palestinian resistance very costly for the Palestinian people. They know that the only way and the only reason that we have a strong Palestinian armed resistance is because it has a popular incubator and a popular support. No resistance would be able to continue its task without people's support. So Israel wants to punish our people every time, there is an action of resistance. We saw that in Jenin lately. We saw that also in other villages and towns in the West Bank. And they want the Palestinians to start, what they call the burning of conscience operation in Jenin in 2003. And that is to, push Palestinians into despair, starvation, making their life, daily life, difficult. But again and again, Palestinians for the past 74 years have demonstrated an iron will in terms of their ability to carry on the tasks of struggle. And that's because resistance for Palestinians is not a matter of just a decision that people make. It's a way of life. Existence is resistance, for Palestinians, whether they are in the West Bank or whether they are in Gaza or Jerusalem or in the diaspora.
Zakir, as you know, the Israeli land grab policy is being pushed further every day. Palestinians are losing more and more of their land and their homes. The settlement expansion is going on. We have 700,000 Israelis living there. So what's on the horizon for the Palestinians? Also on the excuse that they have no construction permits, they're losing their homes, they're being demolished, and no such permits are being issued for the Palestinians. So how much more of their lands will the Palestinians be losing?
I'm going to address your question in two parts. The first, I'd just like to touch on the response of the fellow guest and a colleague. I think I agree on this part, that they are trying to create a cost for the resistance operations, but they failed to do that in Lebanon. 2006, they rolled out something called the Dahiya principle. For each rocket, they have to level a neighborhood in Lebanon so as to cause pressure on the Hezbollah. Today, Hezbollah is stronger than it's ever been. So this principle is doomed to failure. And similarly, I'm going to extrapolate that principle and place it to the question that you posed to me, is that what is the future when so much of Palestinian land is being gobbled by the Israeli machinery? And Israel is painting itself into a corner. It's a very obvious position now, because Israel is facing something called a one-state reality. It is impossible to argue a two-state solution based on secured borders and other ridiculous principles that Israel pulls out of thin air. The reality is now that it is impossible to establish a Palestinian state. It has to be now a one-state solution. You have to look at a South Africa solution. And this means it's the death of the Zionist enterprise. These aren't my words, the words of Ehud Barak and so many others, Tzipi Livni said it at the IDC Hezliya conference a few years ago, and they've said it, that if we do not give equal rights to Palestinians under a one-state banner, we are going to slip into apartheid state, which it already is, and this has been recognized by groupings like Bat Salem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the entire world. I've said this before, the entire world is on one side, and Israel is still holding on to the relic of apartheid, which has already been thrown into the rubbish bin of history.
Mm-hmm. Now, Khaled, when you take a glance at the goings-on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, especially in the past few years, you realize that the more violence and the more crimes committed against the Palestinians, the more resilient they have become, and the more retaliatory and stronger operations they have conducted. So the question is, why shouldn't the Tel Aviv regime not change the policy? Why should it still stick to the same old, you know, heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians?
Because the nature of the Zionist regime is a colonialist settler project that is serving the interests of imperialist forces and of the United States, and particularly the Israeli regime serves also the Israeli capitalist ruling class in this regime. So this is the nature of Israel. Israel cannot exist if it's not an expansionist state, an aggressive state, a state that commit crimes against Palestinian people, and just not just Palestinian people, but also against its neighbors, against its, you know, like the Arab people in general. And we know that there is not one single Arab country that was not attacked by Israel in one form or another. And so that's the nature of a colonialist settler state. And Israel is doomed to fail as a project because the continuation of crimes and massacres and wars, it will only lead to more Palestinian resistance, but it would also would lead to more support for the natural solution, and that is the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, and the establishment of a society that has nothing to do with Zionism and racism and Israel. It must be a secular democratic state that people live from the river to the sea under rule.
Okay.
Africa has a lot of similar what is being so always but that just solution in Palestine must contain the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes.
Now, Zakir, what type of a strategy would you expect a Tel Aviv regime to adopt in the face of Palestinians in the future? Would you expect any change?
Unfortunately, I don't see any prospects of change. I think the system of terrorism, apartheid, genocide, colonialism, and this general occupation mentality is ingrained within Israeli society. It's hard to break free from the mold. When Israel was established on terror, continues to practice terror and will demise while practicing terror. I think the answer to the situation is to continue with the formula. The Palestinian resistance movement in the joint operations rooms have embarked on the principle of Dawla al-Wahda, the mm-hmm. joint movement now. What we are seeing now is, and this is a very key feature of this this conflict right now, is that it's not only the Palestinians. Israel tried to undermine BDS. It's cut the feet of BDS by normalizing with certain Arab states. and trying to attract the wealth from these Arab states. But what has happened in the opposite arena is that you have this massive arc of resistance that is ready to put soldiers and arms at the disposal of the Palestinians and join them in the fight, in the final fight, for the destruction of the state of Israel if it does not reform, which it won't. You have Hezbollah in the north. You have Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq in the last war, 2021, Saif al-Quds. Hashd al-Shaabi was already dispatching troops for the possibility of a large war. You have Ansarullah in Yemen. You have the Palestinians both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and as our dear brother has said, also within Israel proper. You have a complete system that is engulfing Israel, and Israel has no option but to continue with his brutality, and that is how the apartheid regime did the same thing until they read the writing on the wall. The question is, can Israel read?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Now, Khaled, Zakir talked about what the Israelis are going to do. What about the Palestinians, given the situation, you know, so-called normalizations and mediations that failed? And also, of course, we have social media, we have people taking to the streets, even in Western countries, in Europe, in support of Palestinians. But on the ground, they're not receiving much practical kind of support for their cause. So what are they supposed to do?
Well, one of the most important tasks today for Palestinians, and that's an internal Palestinian task, is to establish the Palestinian National Unified Front that could not just carry the tasks of the struggle and resistance in terms of confrontation with the Zionist regime, but also the political tasks. And we have seen the complete failure of the Palestinian Authority and the illusion bath of negotiations. This Palestinian sector that have led the Palestinian Liberation Organization since Oslo until today have failed. And a new leadership has to emerge from Palestinian resistance. And we see that the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, for example, despite all the harsh conditions that they are experiencing, they maintain a unified internal front. We see in Gaza, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, from nationalists to Marxists to religious groups are united in one joint leadership. But this is not enough. It has to translate itself into a political project that it's understood and clear by Palestinians, mm-hmm. and it will be forced on the so-called international community. That is a very tough task, but it is achievable because Palestinians have done this before, you know, at least. And so they are to do this.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Attorney, activist, and political activist Zakir Ahmed Mayat in Johannesburg, journalist and activist Khaled Barakat in Vancouver. Thank you very much for your insight and input. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, the wide net being cast by Justice Department prosecutors as they move beyond charging 6th of January rioters could encompass scores of potential witnesses from both inside and outside of government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Justice Department investigation of 6th of January confronts sprawling cast of characters. Among the challenges facing the federal grand jury recently empaneled to investigate the 6th of January attack on the Capitol is the sheer number of people who might have information relevant to its inquiry. According to a subpoena issued by the grand jury, prosecutors are asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the election. They presumably include two events in Washington in November and December of 2020, that preceded the gathering on the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021, where President Donald J. Trump told the crowd to descend on the Capitol. The subpoena is also seeking records about anyone who provided security at those events and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. Moreover, it requests information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the presidential election. Each of these broad categories could involve dozens of individuals. Taken together, the total number of potential witnesses, or at some point targets, sought after by the grand jury could easily reach into the hundreds. The investigation appears to be in its early stages, and there is no way of knowing at this point where it may go, what crimes it might identify, or who it may ultimately focus on. Many people of interest to investigators might be called only as witnesses. One possible roadmap, at least in terms of who the grand jury may still want to hear from, is the parallel probe by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, which has already interviewed hundreds of witnesses, including on Tuesday, 5th of April, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. A relatively small group of political operatives did the bulk of the work in organizing the pro-Trump rallies in Washington that kicked off after the election and sought to challenge the results, often using the slogan, "Stop the Steal." Prominent among them, according to interviews and documents, was Amy Kramer, a former Tea Party activist who helped create a group called Women for America First. The group set up a cross-country bus tour gathering Mr. Trump's aggrieved supporters behind the baseless assertions of a stolen election. Within hours of the last polls closing on Election Day, Amy Kramer started working closely with her daughter, Kylie Jane Kramer, to set up one of the first Stop the Steal Facebook pages. Both women were involved, often in close coordination with the White House, in planning pro-Trump rallies on 14th of November and 12th of December 2020, and then in setting up Donald Trump's appearance at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021. Two other people who helped Amy Kramer were Jennifer Lawrence and Dustin Stockton, both of whom had once worked closely with Steve Bannon, a former top advisor to Donald Trump. Another organizer for Women for America First was Cindy Shafian, who ultimately broke away from the group to form a new organization, the 80% Coalition, which planned its own event on 5th of January 2021. Then there was a separate group of planners around Ali Alexander, a provocateur who rose in right-wing circles after the election. Mr. Alexander, an associate of Donald Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was part of a group of activists who planned an event at the Capitol itself and marched with the crowd to the building after Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse. Altogether, scores of people spoke at the rallies in November and December and at the gathering on 5th of January and 6th of January. They included people like Mr. Stone, Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and host of the television show InfoWars. The speakers also included pastors, state-level politicians, and anti-vaccine activists. It is hard to know who prosecutors might consider a VIP from these events, especially for the November rally, often known as the Million MAGA March, and the one in December, which is sometimes referred to as the Jericho March. There were dozens of VIPs who attended Donald Trump's incendiary speech at their lips on 6th of January 2021, according to leaked documents from event organizers. That rally also featured appearances by Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and John Eastman, the law professor who was promoting the idea that Vice President Mike Pence could block congressional certification of the Electoral College results. The attendees at the Ellipse speech included Mike Lindell, the MyPillow chief executive who helped spread Donald Trump's lies about a rigged election, and the YouTube stars known as Diamond and Silk, who are prominent Donald Trump supporters. The federal grand jury subpoena examined by the New York Times seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who might have been involved in the effort to delay congressional certification of the election results, suggesting that prosecutors are interested in learning more about the roles that Donald Trump's aides and allies inside the government may have played. It is not clear if any Trump-era executive or legislative branch members have received subpoenas, and there is no public indication that anyone has been targeted for prosecution. But in looking for more information about what was happening at both the White House and on Capitol Hill as Donald Trump sought to stay in power, the House Select Committee has already expressed interest in a range of White House and campaign advisors, as well as contractors who work to set up the rally. They exist in concentric circles in and around Donald Trump's orbit. Among them is Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, who turned over text messages to the House Select Committee that served as a roadmap not just for his own activities, but those of others. He was one of the few people with Donald Trump as the riot at the Capitol took place. Katrina Pearson, a longtime Trump political advisor, was in direct contact with Donald Trump about the details of the rallies on 5th of January and 6th of January 2021, including who would be speaking and what music will be played, according to a former administration official and a House committee. Katrina Pearson attended a meeting in which Donald Trump is said to have discussed wanting the National Guard deployed, anticipating counter-protests. Caroline Wren, a professional fundraiser and a friend of Kimberly Guilfoyle, an advisor to Donald Trump and a girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., was listed on an attachment for a permit that rally organizers gave the Park Police. Megan Powers, a longtime Donald Trump aide, was listed on a rally permit. Among the Republicans in Congress who worked publicly to keep Donald Trump in power were Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all of whom Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, has said helped set the events of 6th of January in motion. "We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting," Ali Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, so that who we couldn't lobby, We could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body, hearing our loud roar from outside. Paul Gossars, chief of staff, has said his office merely promoted Stop the Steal events and was not involved in planning them. Mr. Biggs, who provided a video message for Ali Alexander to play at a 19th of December rally, has denied coordinating event planning with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks, who wore body armour on stage on 6th of January 2021 as he told the crowd to start taking down names, also denied coordinating with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks recently turned on Donald Trump after the former president rescinded his endorsement in a Senate race and said Donald Trump had repeatedly asked him in recent months to illegally rescind the election, remove President Biden, and force a new special election. Mr. Brooks was one of two members of Congress who spoke at Donald Trump's rally at their lips before the attack on the Capitol. The other was Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, who weeks earlier encouraged the public to call members of Congress and lightly threatened them if they did not support Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. Representative Louis Gohmert, Republican of Texas, unsuccessfully sued Mike Pence over his refusal to interfere in the election certification. Other Republicans who used inflammatory rhetoric around that time included Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado, first-term lawmakers who referred to the day as Republicans' 1776 moment. On 21st of December 2020, Donald Trump met with members of the House Freedom Caucus to discuss their plans to challenge Joe Biden's victory. Among those present were Paul Gossar, Mr. Biggs, Mo Brooks, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who were deeply involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to fight the election results. The House Committee has so far asked only three members of Congress for an interview: Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader who engaged in what he called a very heated call with Donald Trump during the riot; Jim Jordan; and Scott Perry. All three men have refused to agree to a voluntary interview.